I am supposed apparently to keep track of the attendance. So please, there's a sheet going around. Make sure that you write your name and sign. Okay. That's, and then at the end of the class, I'll pick it up. Okay. So today, what I am planning to do, other than any other questions you might have, what my plan is to actually do this phase transition stuff that I mentioned last time, a little bit of that, and then shift gears and start talking about search engines, how search engines work. Okay. As I said, this is like an overview of a bunch of ideas in computer science, and I pick the ideas. You can suggest me some. But you know, we'll hopefully by the end of the lectures, you'll have some idea of you know some of the interesting things. Okay, so first, just get back into the mode of what we were doing last time. This was this question that was on the blog. Maybe it's the Labor Day or something, but there were even fewer responses this time. I think we only had how many? Three responses. Remember what I said regarding blog responses? That's sort of the homework for this course, okay? And if you never really responded to anything, then that is not particularly good, okay? So here is the question again. So we were trying to figure out, my friend apparently was asked by his boss to come up with an efficient algorithm for a timetabling problem for the company. We don't know what timetabling problem is, you know, assume it's a hard problem. You know, this guy was unable to come up with anything that runs in less than exponential time. So he was getting a program which is taking forever to run. So obviously this guy wants to go and tell his boss that, look, it's not that I'm stupid that I came up with a really, you know, slow algorithm. Nobody could have done any better. And the point we were arguing last time, that we were discussing last time, is the way you'd say this to your boss in a CS theory perspective is to say that your problem is as hard as the hardest known problems. That's basically the point. Okay. So my friend decided that this is what he would do. He said, he went and told the boss, look, this timetabling problem can be easily converted into a Boolean satisfiability problem. Now, it's well known that Boolean satisfiability is an NP-complete problem. So it's no surprise that I'm unable to solve my problem in any easier way. My question was, is this a reasonable argument? Any idea? Okay. So he's saying that since his problem can be reduced to another problem, okay, which is known to be harder, then his problem must be hard too, okay? So you think that it's a reasonable idea. Any other alternative opinions? Any other opinions? Any other opinions? So let's get a feel for what does it mean to reduce problems. And let's start with actually my favorite joke about mathematicians who tend to solve a new problem by saying, it's just the same as the old problem, which has already been proved, and so I don't need to prove this problem again. Okay? And the classic joke about a mathematician is the following. This guy, you know, was a smoker. And you know, he was reading his book and he was smoking a cigarette and then fell asleep, okay? And then a little later he wakes up, realizes that this cigarette actually has fallen down onto the mattress and the mattress is on fire, okay? So now he realizes that he has to put out the fire, he wakes up, he gets up from the mattress, he looks around, basically there is like a glass which, you know, with water, should have water, but he already drank the water. So he then goes all the way to the bathroom, fills it up with water, comes, pours it onto the mattress, stops the fire, and goes to sleep. Okay? It's problem solved. Couple of days later, same thing happens. Same exact thing happens. So he again wakes up, he realizes that the mattress is on fire because, you know, he's always reading and forgetting to put away cigarette and he sleeps, right? And then this time he looks around, he has the glass, but the glass is now full of water. So what does he do? He throws the water out and says, now the problem has been reduced to a previously solved one, and goes back to sleep. Okay? Keep this in mind, because apart from the fact that it's a funny thing, it's also actually telling you that an easy problem can always be reduced to a hard problem. An easy problem can always be reduced to a hard problem. That doesn't necessarily mean that the easy problem is hard. Okay, so think about the following thing. Make Rav happy is your problem. Okay, or my problem at any rate. Okay, I want to solve this problem. I have a different problem. Make everyone at ASU happy. Everyone at ASU happy. Now, clearly, I can reduce this problem to this problem. Right? In the sense that if you know how to make everyone at ASU happy, then by definition, you also have made Rav happy, because Rav is in ASU. But does that mean that making Rav happy is as hard as making everybody at ASU happy? Do you see what I'm trying to say? Okay? Just because you can convert this to this in polynomial time, and that means if you can solve this problem, you would have solved this problem, that doesn't mean that this problem is hard. They may have been a much simpler way. In fact, all you need to do to make Rav happy is not to fall asleep during the class. Whereas presumably, to make everybody in ASU happy, you need to do a whole bunch of other things. Okay? It's a much, much harder problem. Do you see what I'm saying? So the direction is important. The direction is important. And in this particular case, you could not have essentially, my friend was basically wrong, because he was saying, since my timetabling problem can be reduced to Boolean satisfiability problem, it's as hard as Boolean satisfiability problem. No. If you want to argue that the timetabling problem is hard, you have to argue the opposite way. You have to say that since Boolean satisfiability problem can be reduced to timetabling problem, it's at least as hard as Boolean satisfiability. So in this particular case, if it turns out, unbeknownst to you, that I'm a really hard to please guy, and I am like, you know, maybe Buddha, okay, you know, Gautama Buddha, Siddhartha, who would be unhappy, would have a long face as long as there is even one person in the world who is unhappy. Okay. Now, in that particular case, you have essentially said that making everybody happy can be reduced to making Rav happy. Because the only time Rav becomes happy is when everybody in the world is happy. Okay. In fact, not Rav, Buddha at any rate. Okay. In that case, then I can say that this problem is as hard as this problem. Are there any questions in this? You have to understand this idea. Because of the complexity issue, but also B, because entire computer science and programming involves breaking an egg with a sledgehammer, you know, in the sense that there may be easier way to solve a problem, and you just try to solve it with the first idea you come across, and the first idea might actually be solving it by actually a sledgehammer, which is unnecessary for that particular problem. Okay? So you have to understand that. Okay, let's some more examples. Actually, this is similar to that, I guess. This is sort of my Buddha version, I guess. So in a nuclear family with, you know, a father and a mother and little Tommy, okay, making little Tommy happy and making his entire family happy. These are almost like this, you know, Rav is a subset of ASU, except if you know anything about nuclear families, if the kid keeps on crying, the family is really unhappy. Okay, so one way of making the family happy, actually, so making the family happy can be reduced to making little Tommy happy. So in that particular case, making little Tommy happy is as hard as making the entire family happy. Okay, whereas in this case, not, because you can make Rav happy much simpler ways than by making everybody in the world happy. Now, let's get rid of these simpler ideas and let's think of NP problems and Boolean satisfiability. A general NP problem, I told you, is if I give you the solution to it and you can check it in polynomial time, whether or not it's true. Okay, that's an NP problem. And there is a guy called Stephen Cook. Stephen Cook. Who I think back in early 70s essentially has shown that the problem Boolean satisfiability, which by the way is one of the problems I wanted you to think about and we will talk about a little more today, Boolean satisfiability happens to be an NP problem. In the sense, you know, if I give you the solution to the Boolean satisfiability problem, you can check it in polynomial time. Okay? And what Cook has proved, essentially, and that's the more interesting part, and that you will understand by taking like an advanced CS theory course, okay? But you get the idea of what he tried to do. What he tried to do is pretty much any NP problem can be reduced, not pretty much, every NP problem can be reduced to Boolean satisfiability problem. What that means is Boolean satisfiability is at least as hard as every other problem in class NP. So the only day you can find a polynomial, if you ever can find a polynomial solution to Boolean satisfiability, then the entire class NP has a polynomial solution. Because everything in class NP can be reduced to this problem in polynomial time, and if you know how to solve this in polynomial time, then everything is solvable in polynomial time. That's what, you know, Cook has shown. And so in some sense, the picture that we were talking about last time was that he essentially put in this pink circle, the monsters of the NP world, he put one problem, the first problem, which was Boolean satisfiability. The moment you know one monster, now you can create other monsters. Now you can say some other problem. Sorry. So now I know Boolean satisfiability is a hard problem, that every other problem can be reduced to it. Now there can be problems that are as hard as Boolean satisfiability. Then they too are NP complete problems. Okay? So to actually, for my guy, my friend, to show, for example, that timetabling is a hard problem, what he had to show, it's not enough for him to show that timetabling can be reduced to Boolean satisfiability. That's true. Anyway, every problem can be reduced to Boolean satisfiability. What he had to show was Boolean satisfiability can be reduced to timetabling. That means then basically he's arguing to his boss that if only you could find some smart guy who can solve timetabling problem in polynomial time. I just showed you how you can convert Boolean satisfiability to timetabling in polynomial time. That means you have effectively solved Boolean satisfiability in polynomial time. But we all believe that Boolean satisfiability cannot be solved in polynomial time, although we don't yet have a proof, okay, which is like one of the main, you know, main mathematical theorems that are still outstanding right now. Okay, we sort of believe, just like, you know, there are in how many of you know, how many of you may have heard of Riemann's hypothesis? Okay, Riemann's hypothesis is a hypothesis about prime numbers. Okay, and P equal to NP is a hypothesis about complexity. A whole bunch of mathematics is conditional on Riemann's hypothesis being true, because they'll prove various theorems saying, assuming Riemann hypothesis is true, this theorem holds. A whole bunch of computer science is conditional on P equal to NP. Okay? Assuming P is not equal to NP, we believe the following would be a hard problem. Okay? And so in particular, my friend had to show that assuming P not equal to NP, timetabling, Boolean satisfiability can be reduced to timetabling, and that means if I can solve timetabling in polynomial time, I would have solved this in polynomial time. You don't really believe I could do that, do you? Nobody can do this in the world, so you shouldn't fire me just because I wrote an exponential algorithm. Okay? And this argument won't work when you write an exponential algorithm for sorting. You see that? Basically, you cannot, sorting can be reduced to Boolean satisfiability, but Boolean satisfiability cannot be reduced to sorting. If it can be, then obviously there is something wrong. Okay? So the reductions are important, and you need to understand that an easy problem can always be made harder. The trick is to find, you know, the hard problem that you're stuck with, which you don't quite know how to solve, convert into some another hard problem that you maybe know how to solve. Easy problems can always be made harder. Okay, it's no big deal. Now, one way you can actually make easy problems harder, which we will look at today, is, in fact, what I'm going to do is try to make you understand Boolean satisfiability, because, again, in computer science, Boolean logic, propositional logic, Boolean satisfiability is everywhere. And you will learn it pretty soon after this class anyway, but you would be like a step ahead. You know, instead of wasting just 10 classes here, you might at least have had some pre-tutoring for some of those classes. Okay, so we will talk about Boolean satisfiability, and we'll see that there is a special case of Boolean satisfiability problem called three satisfiability. That means all the constraints turn out to be exactly three classes, three variables long. I'll tell you what that is in a minute. And it turns out three sat is also NP-complete. And the way they prove it, essentially, is that they will say, if you give me any Boolean satisfiability problem, I can then generate an equivalent 3-sat problem, which is only polynomially larger. And so if I can then solve 3-sat in polynomial time, I would have solved this in polynomial time. So 3-sat is just as hard as Boolean satisfiability, because they're both polynomial. Okay? I'm sorry, they're just as hard as Boolean satisfiability, because when you convert Boolean you can convert Boolean satisfiability to 3-sat, you can reduce this to this in polynomial time. In which case, then, if you can solve this in polynomial time, you are in essence solving this in polynomial time, which you don't believe you can. If you can, by the way, you know, I mean, don't just let the weight of the accumulated wisdom set you back. Okay, if you can during like midterms or something find a probably polynomial time algorithm for Boolean satisfiability, come to me, we'll write a paper, we'll both become extremely famous, you can drop out of computer science, and you will be on New York Times front page, and the world will collapse, because all the cryptography, everything will collapse. Okay, but that's fine, at least you'll be famous. Okay, it's like this guy, Terry Jones, the fact that the world collapses, who cares, at least he's famous for a while. Now, let's look at a little bit about satisfiability problem. Because I asked you to look at it, hopefully some of you have looked at the Wikipedia page, but let me try it anyway here. It's a very abstract problem. It turns out you can convert everything into this problem. That's what Cook said, right? Cook said every general NP problem can be converted into Boolean satisfiability problem. Okay? And it's a very simple problem, really. All it is saying is that I'm given some set of propositions. A proposition can only take true or false value. It's either true or it's false. It's only one of them. Okay? So I have a bunch of propositions, P1 to PN, and they can all be true or false. And they're also called Boolean because true can be 1, false can be 0. And so you do the entire computer arithmetic, the computer gates, everything, use Boolean algebra. Okay? Now, in Boolean algebra, you obviously have some operations. If you have true is odd with true, that's in Boolean algebra, it's 1 plus 1. Okay? If you true or true would be equal to true. Is this very surprising to you? You know, if you have one statement, so I say, here is a statement, it will rain tomorrow. That's true, and I'll tell you that's true, and then the sun will rise tomorrow, that's also true. Then the composite statement, it will rain or sun will rise tomorrow, is still true, because both of them are true. Okay, true is true, true or false is true, true and false or false is false, false or true is true. That's the definition of R function. Okay? And in terms of algebra, 1 plus 1 is 1, 1 plus 0 is 1, 0 plus 1 is 1, 0 plus 0 is 0. This is how computer arithmetic works when you look at gates. Okay? Now, the other thing that we need, the only other thing I need, and although there, of course, you can also talk about AND, which is you can describe the semantics of AND, which is suppose A, B, you talk about what are called truth tables, A and B. If A is true, B is true, A and B will be true. If A is true, B is false, A and B will be false. If A is false, B is true, A and B will be false. A is false, B is false, A and B will be false. Okay, in the context of Boolean algebra, what you do is instead of just as R is plus, what is AND operation in algebra, in arithmetic? If you want to think of this operation here as some sort of an arithmetic operation over ones and zeros, what would work? What? Multiplication, right? So essentially what you're saying is 1 times 1 is 1, 1 times 0 is 0, 0 times 0 is 0, 0 times 1 is 0. So Boolean conjunction is product. Boolean disjunction is sum. Okay, the only other thing that I want is a unary operator, which the unary operator that I'm interested in is not of something. So if A is true, what is not of A? If A is true, not of A is false. If A is false, not of A is true. Okay. Now, how can you think of, what do you want to think of this? So, okay, so this is your NOT operation, this is your AND, and then you also look at the OR operation. And it turns out that if you have a bunch of propositions, what you're trying to see is these propositions can have true and false values. Okay, first thing, if I have N propositions, how many distinct true-false configurations can they have? If I have one proposition, how many distinct true-false configurations can it have? What? How many? No, if I have just one proposition, P, it can either be true or it can either be, or it can be false. So how many possibilities are there? Two. If I have two propositions, how many possibilities are there? If I have three, how many possibilities are there? So if I have n, how many possibilities are there? 2 power n. Remember what I said about 2 power n? 2 power n is the demon, is the monster, you know, and it keeps coming up everywhere, okay? Essentially, if you have n propositions, then there are 2 power n possible assignments over them. If you have n Boolean propositions, then you can have 2 power n assignments. Okay. Now, if I don't tell you anything, any of those assignments are reasonable. But now I start making your life hard. And I'll say, I have these propositions p1 to pn, but I also, and I want you to guess some assignment for them. And if I just say guess an assignment, you will pick any of these 2 power n assignments. That would be just as good a guess as any. But now I go on and say, by the way, guess an assignment, but make sure that the clause not P is valid in your guess. Okay? Do you understand what I'm saying? So whatever you guess, you have to make sure that not P is true, which means P has to be false. If I have n variables for which I can guess values, and I have just one constraint saying not P, how many assignments can I guess legally? No, I have n variables. If I didn't have this, I had 2 power n assignments. Any of them would have been a solution. Now I have this one constraint, not P must be true. Then how many assignments are left that I can guess from? One variable has been clamped to a value. And the rest of the guys can still change. Do you understand what I'm saying? There are n variables. The first guy has been clamped to false because if it takes any other value, you are dead. The rest of the variables can still change. How many variables are left? N minus 1. If you have n minus 1 variables, how many assignments can you have? 2 power n minus 1. Okay, so there are two things I'm trying to explain to you here. One is, I just gave you a constraint. The constraint reduced the number of assignments that are still legal. Okay, in this particular case, the number of legal assignments went from 2 power n to 2 power n minus 1. So if you just randomly guess, previously you had probability 1 of being, you know, guessing an assignment that will satisfy all the constraints. Now you have less than that. In fact, you only have 2 power n minus 1 by 2 power n probability, which is how much? What's the probability? 2 power n minus 1 by 2 power n. What? 2 power n minus 1 by 2 power n. What is this number? Probabilities cannot be 2, guys. Right? Probabilities can only be between 0 and 1. 1/2, which is not surprising, right? Because half of your guesses would be wrong, because in half of the guesses you would have said p equal to true, in which case not of p would actually not be true. And so those would all be thrown out. Okay, so in general, as I keep adding these constraints, another constraint I can add is RRW. Okay, I'm sure, in fact, let's assume that my variables are p1 to pn. So let me assume this is not p1, and I can also say p2 or p3. That means whatever is the solution, it must have either p2 true or p3 true. If both are false, it's not a solution. Okay? So these are sort of making your life miserable. You keep adding constraints, then it becomes harder to guess and satisfying assignment. Okay? So in the worst case, I can make your life so miserable that you have to look through all 2 power n assignments, check each of them one by one to see if they satisfy all the constraints until you find one which satisfies all the constraints. And that's why it's a possibly exponential problem. Okay, just because I sketched a possibly exponential solution doesn't mean it's a really hard problem, because I also sketched an exponential solution to sorting problem. But sorting is actually an easy problem. Just that I was dumb. Okay. However, I do know that Steve Cook is standing behind me, because he has shown that Boolean satisfiability is at least as hard as every other NP problem. So in fact, I expect it to be exponential in the end. Okay. So let's look at this problem here, this instance. I have, let's say one example. Put an example in the next one. Okay, I only have 3 propositions, P, Q, R, that's it. Just 3 propositions, okay? And these are my clauses. Okay, the clauses, think of them as constraints. Think of them as constraints, okay? This one says, in the final assignment, either P is true, RQ is false, or R is true. And this one says, in the final assignment, is either Q is true, or R is false, or P is false. Both of these constraints have to be satisfied. Okay? Now, since I have 3 propositions, how many possible assignments can I try? How many possible assignments are there? If I'm guessing, you know, what's the space from which I'm guessing? 8. Okay? So I just have to check if any of those 8 will satisfy both these constraints. If they do, then I'll give it to you, the guy asking the question and saying, here is your satisfying assignment. Are you satisfied? Okay, I mean, leave me alone now. Okay? Now my question is, suppose I guess this. P is false, Q is true, R is false. Is it a solution? Let's try it out. Okay? If P is false, so the way you do it is you use the Boolean logic rule. Okay, you have 2 constraints. Constraint 1, P, R, not Q, R, R. And the constraint 2 is Q, R, not P. And my assignment is P is false, Q is true, R is false. If this is my assignment, is this constraint true? What do I do? So basically, if P is false, then this is false. Or since Q is true, not Q is false. Right? Since Q is true, not Q is false. So this becomes false or false, or R is false. So I'm trying to see whether false or false or false is true. Is false or false true? No. So this constraint is violated. Should I then bother checking this constraint or not? If you're dead once, you're dead, right? There are 10,000 constraints and the first constraint is already violated, then you don't need to check the rest of them. Okay, the answer in this case is this is not a satisfying assignment. And the Boolean satisfiability problem is writing a little computer program, just a little computer program that basically goes through the constraints and looks for an assignment that will satisfy all of them. Okay? And you have already the hope that, you know, mostly the easiest one to do is some sort of an exponential solution, and you kind of know that exponential solution is not too bad because Steve Cook said it's a hard problem. So in fact, you can write a Boolean satisfiability program very easily. Okay. What's interesting is later on you will learn that you can do large number of optimizations for these satisfiability problems. Okay, and such that they can be solved very fast. And you know, I said pretty much every problem in the world in the class NP can be converted to solving this. So if you have a very fast Boolean satisfiability solver engine, it's like having a very fast Intel machine, because you can convert any other problem to Boolean satisfiability and some instance of Boolean satisfiability, and this engine will solve it very fast. Okay. As an example of a problem, like a toy problem, that sort of you may not have realized is connected to Boolean satisfiability. For example, suppose you consider, how many of you know Sudoku? You can, if you have a Boolean satisfiability engine revving up, you can convert Sudoku into a Boolean satisfiability problem. And so it's solved. Okay? And how many of you know this toy problem called N queens, 8 queens problem? How many of you know chess? And I admit, I don't know chess other than how a chess board looks. Okay? In the chess board, right, you know how queens in the chess actually run, right? A queen can go diagonally, can go vertically, can go horizontally. Okay? An 8-queen problem is to place 8 queens on the chessboard such that no two queens are conflicting. So for example, if I put a queen here, then clearly I can't any longer put any queens here, any queens here, any queens here. Right? So if I'm trying to put a second queen, it has to be in either this row or this column or some other diagonal, for example. So the question is, can you place 8 queens on the chessboard such that no two queens would be conflicting with each other? Turns out you can. And turns out that you can do it in many, many ways. It turns out that that's the kind of thing that you don't want to sit in and do it unless you like Sudoku kind of puzzles. Okay? It's like a boring thing to do. I mean, I'm not a puzzle person, so I think puzzles are a waste of time. But what you as a computer scientist should do is you see a puzzle, you write a program, and let the program solve it instead of you solving it. Okay? It turns out that 8 queens problem can be converted very easily into Boolean satisfiability. And I told you about my friend's timetabling problem. It turns out, not surprisingly, that he can convert timetabling problem into Boolean satisfiability problem. Okay, but that is not surprising at all, because anything, as Steve Cook said, every possible NP problem can be converted into Boolean satisfiability. Okay, now comes the phase transition part. But are there any questions on this? Okay, so this is just a silly problem. And you know, guess, for example, what is the largest size of the problems that the current day computers are able to solve within minutes. Okay, so the question is, when you have a problem like this, what are the parameters that are of importance? The size of this problem or the hardness of this problem is determined by what parameters? It's a very simple problem, right? It has variables, a Boolean propositions, and clauses, which are the Boolean constraints. There are only two parameters. Okay? So the difficulty of the problem somehow should depend on number of variables, number of clauses. Actually, in this example, it turns out that both the clauses had the same length. What is the length of a clause? It's the number of propositions that clause is constraining. Okay? In this problem, the clause, this length is 3, this also is 3. Generally, Boolean satisfiability problem doesn't have to just have 3 size clauses. It can have any arbitrary size. So for example, if I only had 3 variables in my entire world, P, Q, and R, I can't have a clause larger than 3, right? Because I can only talk about 3 variables. But if I had a million variables in my world, then a clause can actually be million size, or half a million size, or 300 size. And a general Boolean satisfiability problem essentially is just of this form, P1 or P7 or blah, 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 or P13. You know, in fact, any number of variables and their negations can be thrown in. General Boolean satisfiability. Okay. Now, if I care about general Boolean satisfiability, the parameters that I should care about are number of variables, number of clauses, and average size of clauses. Okay? Because somehow some problems may have very large clauses and some of the problems may have small clauses. This is where, you know, I mentioned something here, right? That Boolean satisfiability is just as hard as 3-SAT. And so, in particular, if I only consider instances of the SAT problem where all clauses are of length 3, then there is a way of showing that any arbitrary Boolean satisfiability problem can be converted in polynomial time to some 3-SAT problem. So if you can solve the 3-SAT problem in polynomial time, then you can solve Boolean satisfiability in polynomial time. So 3-SAT is actually as hard as the general Boolean satisfiability. And what's the word 3, the number 3 in 3-SAT? The clauses are all exactly of length 3. And the reason that's interesting to me in today's discussion is if all the clauses are of length 3, then the number of parameters that I need to care about is only 2, because the average clause length is exactly 3 for every problem. So it's not a distinguishing feature. Okay, so what I want to think about is how hard are 3-SAT problems? If I randomly generate a 3-SAT problem, exactly how hard is it to solve it? Okay, you do know that we believe that the hardest 3-SAT problems would be exponentially hard. That's what we believe. If P is not equal to NP, then the hardest 3-SAT problems should be exponentially long. So the real question is, what happened actually, and this is sort of a bit of a background, you know, whenever people heard this sort of a thing, they, you know, would write a little satisfiability program. You can write this. It's not hard at all. Any computer programming can write a SAT solver. May not be the fastest in the world, but you'll write one fine. Okay? And then they will generate random satisfiability instances and throw it to the solver. And then the solver would actually be solving them very fast. So even though they're doing pretty large instances, they're able to find satisfying instances very fast. So it looked as if the theory is wrong. It looked as if satisfiability problem is not hard after all. Okay? Because my program is actually solving random satisfiability instances very fast, and yet, you know, all these smart people seem to be thinking that satisfiability is a hard problem. And that's where a couple of classes back I was asking you this question. If it is the case that most satisfiability problems that you generate randomly happen to be easy to solve, then exactly where are the hard problems? Where are those ones that are really hard to solve? And the reason this discussion is interesting is, again, it gels well with your common sense as to when does a problem become very hard to solve and when does it become very easy to solve. Okay? To do that, what I would do, in fact, I mentioned this at the end of last class. I said, if I give you a 3 million page homework to be completed by next week, it's an easy assignment. Why? You don't have to waste your time trying to do it. You'll say, ah, the heck, I mean, I'll lose some points. There's no way I can do this. I would not do it. So my rest of my life would not be affected because of this problem, because I just right away stop doing it. If on the other hand, I give you a very small problem, you know, say if P is true, tell me what is not P. That's it for the whole entire week. You would say, come on, why would I want to lose points on this very silly homework? Let me just do it, you know, and then be done with it. The problem comes when I make a homework which looks, you can't tell by looking at it whether it's easy or hard. So you have to actually spend time trying to do it, and then after 3 or 4 hours, you still haven't done it, but the 3 or 4 hours that you spent on my homework are 3 or 4 hours that are lost from your life forever. You'll never get it back. Right? And so the hard problems to some extent live in the middle, and this should not be surprising. The ones, you know, where I can make you spend a lot of time are those problems where they look not too hard, not too easy, and so you will try to start solving it, but then it won't be easy to get the solution. Okay. Now, it turns out that that intuition can be formalized, can be stated formally in the context of three-set problem, and that's a very neat point that hopefully you would, you know, keep thinking about later on too. Remember that I said I have two parameters for a SAT problem. One is the number of variables, or the number of propositions. The other is the number of clauses. And the size of the clauses doesn't matter because all clauses are of the same size. Okay, so in some sense, I want to generate random problems, random SAT problems, and plot how hard they are to solve. Okay, but since I have two parameters here, right now I can't do a two-dimensional plot, can I? Because the independent parameters are these two, and the dependent value, remember your science experiments, the dependent value is the time taken to solve the problem. So rather than do a three-dimensional plot, I will cheat and say, I'll convert these two parameters into one single parameter. All I really care about is the ratio, number of clauses to number of variables. That's just one parameter. Okay? Now I can vary that one parameter on the x-axis and on the y-axis, show you how hard, I mean, and basically, you know, generate a whole bunch of problems which have that parameter as their number of variables to number of clauses. I mean, so number of clauses to number of variables, and see how hard are they on the average to solve. Okay. Before I'll tell you, in the next slide, I'll show you some actual results that people have done, and this is a set of results that are very robust. Even if you go home and do it now, you'll exactly find the same thing. But let's actually develop our own intuition before peeking into the results. Okay? Now, think of this end of x-axis. On this end of x-axis, number of clauses by number of variables is close to zero. What does that mean? Assume finite size problem, so that you don't have to do 0 by 0, no calculus, okay? So how can number of clauses by number of variables be close to 0 if the number of variables is not 0? Yeah, that's fine. I mean, so imagine, so I decided, let's say, number of variables is going to be 100, okay? So how do I make number of clauses by number of variables close to 0? Very few clauses. That means on this end, the constraints are very loose. You're saying everybody can do what they want. You know, here are n variables, but they can take pretty much any values. I really don't care. I'll just give you a couple of constraints. If I give you very few constraints, is the problem going to be easy or hard to solve? Extremely few constraints. It's very easy to solve. And you solve it by actually showing the solution, or you solve it by saying it can't be solved? both ways you can solve a problem, right? And I give you a SAT problem, you can either prove that it has no solution, or you can say here is a solution. Okay, which one will occur this side? What's the probability that a random SAT instance which has many variables and barely any constraints will actually be satisfiable? What? How high can it get? One. Okay? So, the probability, this green thing is the probability of finding a satisfying assignment. Remember there are 2n assignments? You close your eyes, pick one, and see if it is satisfying. Okay? And the probability that the one that you picked is actually a satisfying assignment is what I am plotting here. And if this probability is very high, then pretty much any random program should be able to find a satisfying assignment very fast. Okay? So the probability is close to 1 on this end. On this end, what happens? Here, the number of variables is still 100, and the number of clauses by number of variables is like infinity, or 1,000, or 10,000, or something. How do I get that? Since the number of variables is sort of, so the number of clauses should be many more, or number of constraints should be many more compared to the number of variables. That means your life is too constrained. Okay, I said, here are three variables, P, Q, and R, and here are 10,000 constraints on P, Q, and R. There are only really 8 assignments. You know, how are you going to make sure that all these constraints are going to be satisfied? It's a very high possibility that I sort of posed some constraints which are basically mutually exclusive. They cannot both be satisfied at the same time. Okay? Which means that problem cannot be solved. Okay? And if I ever show you three variables and 10,000 constraints, that's like giving you a 8 million page homework by next week. You would be done very fast and say just, I'll guess that there is no solution, and I would be pretty much right. Okay? So, in fact, on this end, the probability will be close to 0. On this end, the probability of finding a satisfying assignment will be close to 100% or 1. Okay? Now, what about the cost of solving the problem? The cost of solving the problem on this side, since pretty much any assignment will work, you should be able to write a program that will just pick some random assignment and will be able to find that. So the cost of solving the problems on this side will be very close to 0. Cost of solving the problems on this side will also be close to 0, because there you solve the problem by saying it can't be solved. And you will be right. Okay? Now, obviously, you expect that it can't all be 0. You know, at some point of time, it has to fix. Okay? So, you would assume that this probability is of finding a satisfying assignment is slowly falling and becoming 0. And similarly, the cost of finding the solution is slowly raising and then slowly falling back. If you don't expect that, that's because you're not thinking. There's no paradox to find hard problems in the middle. Okay? You can always be find, you know, we can find paradoxes in the world just by not thinking. Everything is surprising for us. Okay? But if you think, at least you can see that problem should be hard in the middle. So what you would expect is that the probability of finding a solution for a random SAT instance sort of gradually falls down and becomes close to 0. And the cost of solving the problem sort of gradually raises and then gradually falls down, becomes 0. This should not be surprising. Okay? What actually happens when you run experiments, just empirical experiments, on generating random SAT instances and plotting x values, which to be number of clauses by number of variables, and these two on the y-axis, is more like this. The probability sort of goes, stays close to 1 up until some magic x value, and then precipitously falls to 0 in a very narrow region. And not surprisingly, the difficulty of solving the problem stays close to 0 for a large range, precipitously goes up in a narrow range, and again comes back to 0. Now, this should explain a lot about why, if you were to generate a random SAT instance, you will find it easy to solve. Because what's the chance that the random SAT instance that you generated would be in this region versus in this whole big region or in this whole big region? Right? Most likely you will be finding SAT instances from this and this, randomly picked SAT instances. But all the monsters live in this region. Now this one I just made up, you know, by hand, but if you look at this last slide, this is actual numbers that people have generated by generating, you know, SAT instances, random SAT instances, and solving them using state-of-the-art solvers, state-of-the-art problem solvers, not just some random, you know, high school dropout code, okay? And yet, they found the same exact thing. Notice that probability is 1, solves extremely fast, becomes 0, and the difficulty is very close to 0, very high, falls off. Now, where approximately is it falling down? Where is the magic value? Remember, the x value is number of causes by number of variables. Symbols are variables. Do you see approximately where the transition is occurring? Just from the code, or just from the plot? Somewhere between 4 and 5. Okay? And it turns out it's approximately 4.3. And if you're into this, nobody knows exactly what the value is. We know it's around 4.3, and people have been actually trying to, first of all, the mathematicians had to prove to themselves that they are not hallucinating, that this can actually happen. And so they proved that when you do this kind, for these kinds of problems, there can be sharp thresholds. That means there'll be a particular threshold where things can change very drastically. And it's not just true for satisfiability problem. It's also true for things like Hamiltonian circuit. It's also true for things like Euler circuit. Many, many combinatorial problems tend to have this phase, okay? And the second part is the exact place where the phase transition occurs. People have only been able to theoretically prove that it sort of somewhere around the region 4.3. Nobody has been able to come up with the exact number, which shouldn't matter to you. Like, do you care whether what is the exact value of pi? If you're in Indiana, pi would be 3.12 because they have a rule saying pi is 3.12, okay, for a while at least, because that made their life simpler. You know, because farmers were asking exactly how much of the area do we have, and if pi is like a simple fraction, 22 by 7, it'll be easier to solve, okay? But pi does have a real value, even though we can't write it down, and from a mathematics point of view, you want to know the exact value. From a computer science point of view, you would still be interested in knowing that all the bad guys live in this very narrow region of 4.3 clauses per variable. And if you think about it, that should be mind-blowing. Because why should everybody be congregating there? It's not surprising that the hard problems live in the middle. It's surprising that all hard problems live around 4.3. It's not surprising that water tends to become vapor. It's surprising that all of water wants to become vapor exactly at 100 degrees centigrade. That's why it's interesting. Boiling point is interesting. General evaporation is not interesting. Okay, so we'll stop here. Next time when I come, I'll change gears and start talking about search engines, how Google works, and how do you compare files, how do you compare similarities, how do you think of importance of sites and so on. Okay.